Hey, Chris Garlock here, wishing you and yours a very happy new year. 2020 was certainly a historic year, and here on the Labor History Today podcast, the past and present kept colliding in interesting and unusual ways. Back in August, Quincy Mills, professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park, talked with us about black barbers, the evolution of their trade, and its political meaning as a skilled form of labor. The show also featured poet Martin Espada reading his poem Castles for the Laborers and Ballgames on the Radio, written for his friend historian Howard Zinn. Here's our show from August 30th, 2020, updated with today's labor history in two. Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
Imagine someone in 1968 going into a white barber shop and asking the white barber to trim his afro. It's not the sight that we would imagine, right? It's not the kind of space that that person likely wants. And largely because, you know, barbershops, yes, are businesses, and they are spaces where the production of black culture takes shape.
EMTs, nurses, bus drivers, and supermarket clerks, they're all what are now known as essential workers. But I can tell you that by about June of this year, I know a lot of people who are starting to argue that barbers provided an essential service that they had lived too long without. This week, LHT's Patrick Dixon spoke to Quincy Mills, professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park, about black barbers, the evolution of their trade, and its political meaning as a skilled form of labor.
He was older than the breadlines of the Great Depression. Before the war, he labored at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, even organized apprentices.
That's poet Martin Espada from his poem Castles for the Laborers and Ballgames on the Radio, written for his friend and compañero, historian, teacher, and activist Howard Zinn. Born on August 24, 1922, Zinn wrote more than 20 books, including his best-selling and influential A People's History of the United States and his memoir, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. On this week's Labor History in Two, Rick Smith tells us about the day that a ship sailed into Long Island, New York.
The Amistad served as a Spanish slave ship. 53 captives, led by an enslaved rice farmer by the name of Joseph Sink, had revolted against their captors and taken control of the ship.
That's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. We'll begin with Martin Espada's poem for Howard Zinn. I met Howard in early 2009 when he was in Washington for a sneak preview of The People Speak, the film based on A People's History of the United States, Zinn's seminal 1980 book, which takes a very different approach to American history. Instead of the usual fundamental nationalist glorification of country, Zinn revealed the exploitation and manipulation of the majority by rigged systems that hugely favored the elite across party lines. As Zinn told us that night, we want to make people class conscious, race conscious, environment conscious, and every other kind of conscious. We were planning to screen the film in the DC Labor Film Fest, and I presented Zinn with a Labor Film Fest t-shirt. He was obviously much more of an Oxford button-up shirt kind of guy, but he graciously accepted the t-shirt and even posed for a photo with me. As you'll hear from Martin Espada, that kind of patience and generosity of spirit was typical of Howard Zinn, and I was very sad to hear of his death just a year later.
You have a poem in here to your late friend, Howard Zinn. Would you read it for us?
This one? Mm-hmm. Howard Zinn. was a very dear friend of mine. I think he was the most decent, most generous human being I have ever known on a personal level.
And a real radical.
And a true radical.
Challenged the system, challenged the conventional wisdom.
Yes.
Put himself on the line advocating, marching, protesting.
Literally, he did it all. And I wrote two poems for Howard. And, you know, we've been talking about poetry and what it does, what it doesn't do. I wrote a poem for Howard immediately after his death in 2010 for the purposes of reading it at a memorial service. And poets are often called upon, like preachers, like politicians, to say something when somebody dies. And in fact, there really are no words adequate for that moment. And so I wrote a poem. It didn't quite say what I wanted it to say. I had to wait almost 3 years to find the words that I wanted to say, words of farewell, words of thanks for my friend Howard Zinn. And so the second poem is much more personal, much more intimate, very political at the same time, because it wouldn't be true to me or to Howard without that quality. But here it is. And this appears in the current issue of the Progressive magazine, a special issue called Living Our Values. It's called Castles for the Laborers and Ball Games on the Radio, for Howard Zinn, 1922 to 2010. We stood together at the top of his icy steps, without a word for once, squinting at the hill below and the tumble we were about to take, heads bumping on every step till our bodies rolled into the street. He was older than the breadlines of the Great Depression. Before the war, he labored at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, even organized apprentices, but now there was ice. I outweighed him by 100 pounds. When my feet began to skid, I would land on him and hear the crunch of his surgically repaired spine. The books I held for him would fly away like doves disobeying an amateur magician. "Let's go back in the house," I said. "Show me the baseball Sandy Koufax signed to you," from one lefty to another. Instead, he picked up a blue plastic bucket of sand, the kind of pail good for building castles at Coney Island, tossed a fist of sand down onto the sun-frozen concrete, and took the first step delicately. Again and again, he would throw a handful of sand in the air like bread for pigeons, then probe with the tip of his shoe for the sandy place on the next step. Sand, then step. Sand, then step. Every time he took a step, I took a step. An apprentice shadow studying the movements of his teacher, the body. This is how I came to dance a soft shoe in size 14 boots, grinding my toes into the gritty spots he left behind on the ice. I was there. I saw him turn the tundra into the beach with a wave of his hand, Coney Island of castles for the laborers and ball games on the radio, showing the way across the ice and down the hill into the street where he spoke to me the last words of the last lesson. You drive.
He would have said, "Oh, shucks," but he would have liked it very much.
Poet Martin Espada, from his poem Castles for the Laborers and Ball Games on the Radio, written for his friend and compañero, historian, teacher, and activist Howard Zinn. EMTs, nurses, bus drivers, and supermarket clerks, they're all what are now known as essential workers. But I can tell you that by about June of this year, I know a lot of people who are starting to argue that barbers provided an essential service that they had lived too long without. This week, LHT's Patrick Dixon spoke to Quincy Mills, professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park, about black barbers, the evolution of their trade, and its political meaning as a skilled form of labor. Mills is the author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America.
Thank you for joining us today. I was hoping I could ask you a very broad question to begin with. Some of our audience frequent black barbershops, but many do not. There's a broad public perception in the US of black barbershops as freewheeling forums of public discussion of the events of the day. From time to time, I suspect many of us will have read a news story in which a journalist sought to take the temperature of a community by visiting a barbershop. Considered from a historical perspective, is this an accurate analysis?
Yes, that is an accurate analysis. However, I would start that analysis not with the black barbershop as a public space for black people. I would start it as that analysis with an understanding that barbershops are businesses. And I think that's important to note for a few reasons. First, when we look at the historical trajectory of black-owned barbershops, what we know is that during the 19th century, the commercial black-owned barbershops, meaning barbershops that were in downtown business districts in the South and certainly in the North, catered to wealthy white businessmen and politicians. And so many of these barbers were in the South were free. There were some enslaved barbers who were apprentices in these free black barbers shops. But certainly considering the concerns around enslaved people gathering and potentially plotting insurrections, free black men could not frequent black barbershops in the same way that white men did. So therefore, these black barbershops were exclusively grooming white men. So the black barbershop that we think of today and we know intimately about didn't so much exist in that way in the 19th century. It kind of makes sense during slavery. No, I shouldn't say makes sense, but we can certainly see the larger politics, the racial politics in the South. But those politics extended to the North as well. And so black men who were barbers were able to achieve a modicum of wealth catering to white men. And so it's important to sort of think about the early history of barbers within this racial lens, but also think about its genesis as a way to achieve some sense of economic autonomy. There were many enslaved barbers and who used the skill of cutting hair and shaving to save up a little bit of money and certainly purchase their own freedom or purchase the freedom of family members. It's not until the late 19th and early 20th century where black-owned and black-patronized barbershops begin to emerge. And briefly, this comes about with major labor competitions with German barbers, to some extent Italian barbers, and later in the early 20th century, native white barbers who were essentially sort of jockeying for space in downtown business districts, formed a barbers union, which we can talk about more later, and in many ways pushed for licensing laws which regulated who could become a barber and where those shops could be located. But we also see African-American men who came in the late 19th century, the 1890s, and were looking to open barbershops in black communities. And so which is the rise of Jim Crow for sure. And so at the point that Jim Crow's on the rise, black communities begin to turn inward, meaning they began to focus on the needs, the services, the wants of black people, that those commercial barbershops begin to take on social and political aspirations, meaning that they would be spaces where men could come and talk and think about the larger racial, political, and economic world around them. And so if we think about that early history and make connections to today, movies like Barbershop are funny, entertaining, and provide, I think, a nice message. But the message that we tend to forget from that movie, but also from history, is that those public spaces don't exist if the barbers don't make money. So that means that we have to certainly think about the barbershop both as a business and as a public space. And bringing the two together, I think, is what's most fascinating about Black barbershops.
When we think about the 19th century then, whether it's before the Civil War or after the Civil War,
sure,
in an era in which people's economic, specifically Black people's economic opportunities are severely curtailed, how would an individual become a barber? Is it naive to think that someone might have a particular interest in grooming and questions of style, and that was what attracted them?
I would argue that in the 19th century, what attracted Black men to barbering were that there were very few barriers to entry. So white men didn't want to be barbers because they associated barbering with unskilled labor. And they thought that white men were above doing unskilled labor. They thought that the skilled labor was meant for them and that unskilled labor was meant for Black people. And now, of course, this was a fantasy and a farce. Because if anyone has either held a straight razor or has been shaved with a straight razor, I bet you would certainly want that person to be skilled. Mm. And so, but again, I think part of the way that white men racialized barbering was because they were grooming white men, and largely because of the nature of service work. And so barbering is in the service, it was and still is in the service industry. And certainly when handling a man's face, that took on a certain kind of menial or manual labor that white men thought was beneath them. And so there were very few barriers to entry. It didn't take a lot of capital it didn't take any capital to become a barber. It did not take a lot of capital to open a barber shop. And so whether one wants to be an owner or just cut hair, right, there was a way in which that was fairly easy to sort of get into. And then two, it allowed one to work for themselves. So whether one was a barber in a shop or the owner of the shop, both work for themselves, which is what I find so fascinating about the industry of barbering, is because these are not wage laborers, right? So even if one doesn't own a shop, one actually still works for themselves, right? Because the nature of the economy of the barbershop is such that every barber will give the owner a certain percentage of their intake, right? But the customers are in some ways most committed to the barber. And so if a barber, essentially, who's not the owner, leaves the shop, often his customers will leave with him, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not the same kind of authority and autonomy that wage workers have, especially if they're producing commodity products. And so this is, a way to achieve a sense and a reality of economic autonomy that agricultural labor just did not provide, right? Sharecropping did not provide that kind of independence. It was, right, the opposite, very dependent, perpetual debt. So barbering was that space where Black men could enter, even if they didn't want to be barbers long term. What we see historically is that many men entered barbering as a springboard to something else, whether it's a springboard to politics, a springboard to other businesses, but it was an entryway to a number of other avenues, again, that started with the independence and the financial benefits of working for oneself.
You described that some barbers cut and shave Black clientele and some barbers cut and shave white clientele, but very rarely does this take place in the same premises. Are Black barbers within these two categories viewed differently within their own communities?
Let me answer that question two ways. First, in the 19th century, that was not the case. So much so that black men who could not enter black barbershops in the 19th century actually staged protests against these barbers and barbershops. The historical evidence is not quite clear on the public venues in which black men got shaved and haircuts. I can only surmise that that black men were getting their haircuts at other people's homes, right? In the backyard, the front yard, but not in commercial spaces.
I see.
In the 20th century, yes, right? We have black barbershops serving black men and white barbershops serving white men. And yes, it was very rare that you'd have what some would call integrated barbershops. And frankly, I would argue that even today, that happens often for sure, but it's still a bit rare. I think your question is, why is that the case? So there's a kind of intimacy that happens in black barbershops. The intimacy of community, the intimacy of racial politics, and certainly the particulars of hair type. And race is bound up in all of that. And so even though in the post-World War II period, so 1950s and 1960s, there were a number of protests, many African Americans and civil rights organizations such as CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality, staged sit-ins at white barbershops that would not cut black men's hair. And there were many African Americans who were part of those protests. What's interesting about those sit-ins is that while they were protesting black men were protesting because they could not get haircuts in these white barbershops, the irony is that they actually didn't want to get haircuts in these shops in any sustained way. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what I find to be most fascinating about the dawn of integration and the ways that we talk about black businesses after 1965 is that integration essentially was the death of black businesses. But that's not the case with black barbershops, beauty shops, not the case with black churches, right? They remain quintessentially black. And that is because an African-American cannot get the same kind of an experience in a white barbershop as they can get in a black barbershop. And that experience, one is, does this barber know how to cut my curly or tightly coiled hair, right? Does this barber know how to provide the kind of style or design that I want in my hair? So one is about the skill of the barber. Two is about the community of the shop, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine someone in 1968 going into a white barber shop and asking the white barber to trim his afro. It's not the sight that we would imagine, right? It's not the kind of space that person likely wants. And largely because, you know, barbershops, yes, are businesses, and they are spaces where the production of black culture takes shape. And so, and that's to say that, right, those 1950s, 1960s protests of white barbershops were similar to the sit-ins at restaurants that the great Ella Baker talked about, right, where she said that those sit-ins were bigger than a hamburger. Mm. In many ways, those sit-ins at barbershops were bigger than haircuts. It was about access, and it was about being sure that African Americans could go wherever they want to go. And frankly, there were many African students and diplomats in the 1960s who, particularly in D.C., who would come to D.C. And frankly just want to get a haircut as quickly as they could, and they would often go to these white barbershops that were the first one that they saw, essentially they weren't as rooted in the community of black barbershops, and so they just wanted a haircut from anyone. And so that's where we see a lot of these protests happening in the 1960s. And so there's a way in which, you know, people should have choices, right? Someone might actually want to go to a Supercuts if they would like. So they shouldn't be denied that access. At the same time, what we see is that most African Americans actually prefer to spend their time and energy in black barbershops in various cities.
Like many people, I feel like I have the experience of youthfully entering a barbershop and asking an older generation of barber to apply some sort of fashionable or edgy hairstyle, and then departed later disappointed with something that seems a lot more conservative than what I requested. Is there a degree to which elder black barbers or different generations of barbers and younger clientele clash over political ideas of what's presentable, what styles best represent black men?
Yes, I have a wonderful story that illustrates this point perfectly. When I was doing the research for my dissertation and book, the book Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America, I had dreadlocks that came down to my waist. And right about 2003, I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and Durham, North Carolina, looking for older barbers, barbers who had been cutting hair before 1970, to interview. And so part of my strategy was to, you know, either be introduced to barbers or simply walk in black neighborhoods and peer in the window of barbershops and see if there looked to be an older gentleman in there in the shop and go talk and introduce myself, etc. I was expecting the jokes about cutting my hair, the jokes about, you know, doing the interview in the barber's chair while the barber cut my locks off. But I was not expecting the resistance to being interviewed because I had dreadlocks. And so some of the responses I received from those barbers were, one barber said, what does it mean that you are looking to interview me about barbering and you haven't cut your hair in I don't know how long? Another barber said, I'm in the grooming business and you don't look groomed. And, you know, after a good number of these rejections, I came across a barber in Durham who asked me, was I having trouble getting older barbers to interview? And, you know, I fibbed a little bit, but I fibbed in order to get research data, so to speak, right? I fibbed to get a sense of what he might say. And so I responded by saying, no, it hasn't been that difficult. Why do you ask? It was the why did you ask I was most interested in. And so he said, predictably, well, because we don't like that kind of hair. Another barber in New York said that my long locks looked feminine. And so while most of these rejections were in the South, and the last person I mentioned was in the North, what was clear was that these barbers saw their work in a particular kind of way. They asked me, how would I get a job with locks? They saw their work as a very noble profession, helping black men look good, look presentable, look employable, and in many ways look dateable, right? Mm. And so those rejections were actually quite helpful for me because it really cemented in my mind the importance of work when we talk about barbershops, right? The importance of thinking about the work that these barbers do in their shops outside of the talk and the debates and the jokes, right? that this is labor. This is a labor of love that they see themselves involved in. And so, yes, I think in many ways, all the barbers sort of see their work as, again, shaping and grooming a race of men. We also see this in the 1960s when Afros and Naturals emerged. Again, major political statement. Young Black men and women growing their hair out, Naturals. And one with, you know, we all think about this as a very political, self-affirming moment of Black pride. And that's true. Barbers also saw it as a loss of revenue, right? And so they man, at least to get their Afros and Naturals trimmed and shaped, they saw the Afro and Natural as a threat to their business. In some ways, they couldn't do anything about it, right? History was what it was. And so it was moving in a particular direction. And so those who were, I would say, smart, frankly, rolled with the tide and simply tried to convince young men and women to come into the barbershop to get it shaped. At the end of the day, right, those barbers in the 60s understood the political moment, but they also understood their work and their task and their vocation as one of, again, grooming a race of people who, to confront a largely racist and hostile white world.
Having considered barbers and barbershops over the course of 200 years, do they retain the political capital that you've described them possessing in earlier eras, or are they the first businesses to suffer from gentrification?
There are two questions there. So yes, I do think they retain the political capital that they have come to gather over the course of the last 200 years or so. Essentially, that's to say that, you know, the political capital of Black barbershops was made, and it's dynamic, and it gets remade over and over, right? And I think we're in a moment where it's being remade again now. And so, and one reason why I believe that political capital remains is two reasons. One, the spaces that Black people control, I argue, will always be spaces where there's political capital. So the Black church has political capital because Black people own those spaces. They have control and autonomy and authority over those spaces, which is why they were essential locations during the Black freedom struggle. Black barbershops certainly maintain some political capital, again, because there is usually, COVID is different. I'll come back to COVID in a second, but usually, right, yeah. In a non-COVID moment, there's a what I call always a waiting public in this space. And it's the waiting public that captures the American imagination around Black barbershops. And so there's the barber and there's the customer in the barber's chair. Right, two different constituents. Mm-hmm. The third constituent is this waiting public, a group of men and women who are sitting in the waiting chair, either waiting to get in the barber's chair or simply talking and engaging. It's this waiting public that itinerant entrepreneurs, guys who are and women who are selling incense and oils, and they know there will likely be a group of people hanging out and around in a barbershop, right? This is the kind of model, essentially, that Facebook is built on. Facebook is built on a community of people coming together. And advertisers know that there's a community of people there, and so they partner with Facebook. This is the barbershop, right? And so, and certainly newspapers, right? The Black press have historically sort of situated themselves or their papers in Black barbershops because there are a group of people in this space reading the articles and discussing the issues of the day. And so as long as you have that constituency there, yeah, the political capital will always be there. It's a very manly political capital too, I should say. And so when every so often we hear about political candidates looking or journalists who are looking to assess the mood of black voters, they go to black barbershops and they write about black political engagement in barbershops. They rarely go to black beauty shops. And so there's a way in which, and that's, again, very, very gendered in the way that we think about barbershops versus beauty shops. But beauty shops, too, have that same political capital, but it's marginalized in very unfortunate ways. And so COVID, in some ways, has, you know, taken that community away from shops and from the larger public sphere, for sure. But how this gets remade will be interesting, because there are many barbershops that are now appointment-based, because they kind of have to be appointment-based. And if there were some barbershops, many barbershops that were appointment-based before COVID, for sure, but with appointment-based barbershops, that community, I am concerned, might go away, right? Those, that waiting public might become smaller and smaller. And so it's something I think to keep in mind. But what I think is really critical, particularly as you asked me a question about how cities are becoming gentrified and where barbershops are situated in that larger process of movement and displacement. Yes, there are many barbershop owners who are leasing their spaces, and they're finding themselves unable to afford rising rents. And that's a concern, largely because barbers, in many cases, especially older barbers, you know, likely have cut the hair of two or three generations of families. And they have a sense of what the community has been and what it is. And so, you know, those kinds of institutional leaders and elders, once, you know, if they get displaced, it can be a larger effort of losing community history and community archives, if you will, right? And so, yes, that political capital still exists, but I think that current processes of viruses, racism, gentrifying neighborhoods are threatening it.
But so what you're sort of getting at is, in a way, that to some degree the free market might mean that there are people get moved from A to B, and there are barbershops that open up in the new centers of location, but there's a certain institutional memory that's lost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think certainly, you know, when African Americans have moved out, where they have moved out of black neighborhoods, maybe moved to the suburbs, or what we know is that they traditionally go back to the church, the black church that they grew up in, and they go back to the black barbershop or beauty shop that they were frequenting before they moved. And so there's still this connection, even though, again, black middle class folk, you know, when they move out, they move out, but they don't necessarily leave. But if those spaces like barbershops get displaced, right, then that becomes yet another reason for them not to come back, potentially. And so, yeah, the market economy has, but we certainly know it has historically sort of ravaged black communities in all sorts of ways. As we think about black barbershops, it's rearing its head in this way too.
I do appreciate your time today. It's very generous of you. Really a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
Quincy Mills, professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park, speaking about black barbers, the evolution of their trade, and its political meaning as a skilled form of labor. Mills is the author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day local AFL and CIO unions in Stamford, Connecticut, joined forces to bring out 20,000 members from 30 trade unions in a massive one-day general strike to support striking machinists at Yale and Town Lock. The machinists had been out on strike since November, demanding a 30% wage increase and a union shop. The combined Stamford labor organizations had promised action if Governor Raymond Baldwin did not withdraw state police from interfering with peaceful picketing. The state police were being used to attack the picket lines, arrest strikers, and escort scabs into the plant. In a last-minute attempt to avert the general strike, Yale and Town President W. Gibson Carey Jr. offered an 18% raise, but refused any talk of a closed shop. So the unions went on an extended lunch hour, effectively bringing the entire city to a standstill. Numerous small businesses closed their shops and joined in support. Marchers converged upon Town Hall from five directions. Their placards read, "Stamford is a union town. Let's keep it. And we will not yield victory." Workers represented unions like the Mine Mill, the American Federation of Musicians, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the Barbers Union, Bookbinders, Gas and Chemical, and United Steelworkers, among many others. World War II veterans carried a banner that read, "We licked the Axis, and we can beat Kerry." Despite public support, pitched battles continued on the picket lines. The company would not budge until April, when they finally accepted the proposal the machinists had demanded back in January. The machinists quickly ratified the contract. They beat back a union-busting offensive and built local solidarity among unions at a time when the AFL and CIO were very much at odds.
Rolled through the bullets, we rolled through the fire.
Freedom ride.
If we don't reach our destination, what will that say about the nation? Black and white sitting side by side. Freedom ride.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. And you can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. The Martin Espada reading originally aired on Moyers & Company in 2013. Today's music is Freedom Ride by the R.J. Phillips Band. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide, 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 60 great labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.